The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
Well, what I'd like to do before we get into the formal talk, and hopefully we'll have a little bit of time for Q&A and some feedback at the end as well, but I would like to welcome you all to Top 10 Ways to Cause Your Students to Hate the Great Books. My name is Bruce Satter. I'm the head of school for Wilson Hill Academy. And so, you know, I trust we have a room full of literature nerds, right? How many of you actually teach literature? Maybe history? Oh, basically all of you. Okay. You know, one of the things I always like to get, just kind of one of those curiosities I have, are favorite books of literature teachers. So I just, throw a hand up and let me point at you and just favorite. Well, okay, wait a second. We always have to give the disclaimer, apart from the Bible, what is your favorite? Got to give that disclaimer. So apart from the 66 books of the Bible and more if you're not Protestant, what is your favorite book? Yes. Iliad, way high on my list. The Aeneid, that's actually mine. The Aeneid is actually mine, apart from the Bible. Paradise Lost, all right. Do you have a favorite book? I'm going to come back to you. All right. Second Coming, very good, thank you. Any others? Scarlet Letter, good one, okay. Do you have a favorite book? You're up because the spotlight's on you right now. I don't. So you have to be a literature teacher to have a favorite book. Oh, Calvin, yes. Very good. Maybe you should be a literature teacher. Any others? Come on. I love hearing these. Favorite books? Yep. Hobbit, good. Just yell them out. Paradise Regained, good. Thank you. I saw another hand up over here. For those of you just coming in, we haven't started yet. We're sharing favorite book apart from the Bible. Yeah, very good. Yeah, I saw a lot of heads nodding on that one. This is fantastic. Yes. Cimmerillion, good. Pride and Prejudice, yes. I referred to my wife earlier in a conversation as Mrs. Bennett, and she looked at me and said, "That is not a compliment." Oh, ouch. Any others? Count of Monte Cristo. What a great story. Any others? Yeah. Oh, that's creepy. No, but that's one of my favorites, too. I like it. I made the mistake of reading that one late at night the first time I read it, and I haven't actually slept since. That was 94. So anyway, yes. Frankenstein. Oh, this is a more disturbing group than I thought it was going to be. Woo. Any others? Jane Eyre. Oh, and Ovid. Right? You're the Ovid fan, right? Okay, I like it. All right, for those of you in the back, appreciate your patience. I know we're trying to figure out how we can seat some more folks without violating fire marshal codes and that kind of thing. So, I know that you're here because you have a calling, right? You have a vocation, and you've been called to figure out new and creative and fantastic ways to cause your students to despise reading, to hate the great books, to never want to pick up a book ever again when they leave your class. Never fear, I've got it all worked out for you here, okay? So we're going to figure out how you would do that. So I'm just kind of curious, before I get into my top, I'm doing kind of like a Letterman top 10. I know some of you are probably not even old enough in here to know who Letterman is. I know that's sad. So we're going to do the Letterman top 10 in a minute, but I'm just kind of curious, What do you guys think are some of the top ways, some of the top things that you can do to cause your students to hate the great books? Yeah. Ignoring their questions. Oh, I knew we were going to say that, I would have ignored you. But anyway, that's good. I like it. Oh.
Hours of comprehension questions.
Oh, good grief. Can I bang my head up against a brick wall just a few more times? Hours and hours of comprehension questions. Oh my goodness, let's just cause them to despise it. Making them read everything by themselves. Excellent, yeah.
Long hours of
Oh. Longer the better. Longer the better. Yep. Long reading. Unrealistic. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just sit back and we're going to have story time. And it's over 4 hours later. And everyone is actually asleep. Yeah. Ooh, I like that. Refusing to appreciate the story. Okay. Well, I think you guys pretty much got it figured out, so I think we're done here. No, I do have a top 10. So let's take a look at that. My top 10 might be different than yours, but I do want to hear what you have to say. Number 10 of the top 10 ways to cause your students to hate the great books. Always have them read every page of every book that you study. Always do that. Tell them that they haven't really read Thucydides or Livy or Ovid if they haven't read every single page. Make it the priority to get through the book rather than slowing down to do any of those terrible things that you guys just mentioned earlier. Number nine, top 10 ways to cause our students to hate the great books. Never. Oh, this is a killer right here. Don't ever talk about how the books can be relevant in our lives today. Don't ever talk about relevance. You've got to be sure that you keep the reading and the study of the book in the time period of that book. If you're reading Herodotus, you need to make sure you keep it in the 5th century. If it's Dante, leave Dante in the Middle Ages. Don't ever bring Dante to the 21st century. Whatever you do, do not ever draw any sort of applications of those books to settings in our world today. And definitely do not discuss the ideas of those. You better highlight this one. Don't discuss the ideas of those books in a way that would actually impact our personal lives today. So number 10, make sure that you make it a priority that they always are going to read every page of every book and be as irrelevant as you possibly can. Number 8, always study the easiest ideas with which to interact. Make sure you do that. Make sure that you don't dig into any areas of substance. After all, they're really young. And they're just not ready for substantive discussion and debate. And you'd probably just scar them psychologically somehow if you tried to push for that. So make sure that you always give them what I call the 4 Sunday school answers. And you guys all know what they are. What are they? Jesus, God, Bible, pray. Every question that you ask should be able to be answered by one of those 4. Jesus, God, Bible, pray. If you get outside of Jesus, God, Bible, pray, you're probably violating number 8. All right. Number 7. Technology. Always avoid discussions of technology and how to use technology in an effective and mature manner. What you want to do, well, guys, it's a little easier for this. Ladies, I'm not going to advise you on your apparel, but you can figure this out. But for the guys, what you do is you've got the bow tie. Get the bow tie and the jacket, and you got to have the right glasses. And you need to be as bookish and nerdy as you can and fumble and bumble about when it comes to discussing and using technology, because we're bookish people, right? We're bookish people. We're not technologically advanced people. So joke about being a Luddite. Joke about how, you know, you sort of like maybe living in the 17th century when, you know, people died when they were 26 and that kind of thing. So that's a very important one. Number six has to do with your method, your teaching method. Lecture. Lecture, lecture, lecture. And then when you're done lecturing, be sure that you save some time at the end for more lecturing. Yes. Long periods of time. The key here is to keep on talking nonstop for the entire class period. Resist the temptation to stop and ask for any input from your students. Do not ask any leading questions. And you should probably have either a reminder for yourself or even something on the wall, something that says the Socratic method with a big X through it. And just to remind you, that you can't go there, somebody might start enjoying something or want to get involved in a discussion in the back somewhere, and you gotta squash that quickly. You don't want to ask their opinions on anything. I mean, come on, they're 13. What do they know? Really, what do they know? Don't ask their opinions. Just lecture, and then keep lecturing. Number five, always act like you know everything. Okay. It doesn't matter if you do. I know you don't. You know you don't. But you got to act like you do, because you're the teacher, and they won't respect you if they think that you don't. You know, sort of like, how am I going to respect you? What are your credentials? Why are you even here? So you've got to always act like, you know, you're the expert. You can't let students know that you're not omniscient. You have to have an air about you that says, I know it all. You'll be a lot more successful in causing your students to hate the great books if you can find ways to sort of stultify them as much as possible. Just make them look really silly as you promote your own, you know, sense of intelligence. So far, how are you guys doing with that? I mean, you guys probably already implemented some of these, right? I mean, are you doing okay with these? Okay. Number four. Number four also has to do with your teaching style. Whatever you do, if you don't take my advice on the lecture thing earlier, okay, you're going to blow it, first of all. But let's just say you want to go out on your own and not listen to the seminar guy, and you decide to do something else. Pick one type of lesson and stick to that method the whole year. Whatever you do, do not vary. As I said earlier, the best choice is lecture, but whatever type of lesson you choose, stick with it. Be consistent. Variety is evil. You can write that down and tell your headmaster when you get back, what did you learn at the ACCS conference? Let's all say it together. Variety is evil. Socratic method, bad. Okay. I think you guys are learning some things. This is fantastic. Beware. Number three. Beware. Everybody put a star by this one. No, I didn't just say that to rhetorical. No, this is put a star by. Okay, you ready? Beware of students having fun. This is dangerous. Squash it. Kill it. Never teach with any kind of enthusiasm. If something unexpected happens, like maybe you slip into, that nasty R word, relevance, or you accidentally say something that's funny or something like that, whatever you do, just kill it. Start talking about dead puppies or something like that, but just get rid of it. You got that? Thank you so much. I like this. You guys are scaring me. Okay. The key here is to be monotone. If you enjoy a text, you can never let that be known. Okay, it's fine if you want to enjoy your Ovid or your Jane Eyre or your Frankenstein over here or your 1984, that's fine. But if they find out about it, see that right there? No. Okay, everyone, I want you to show them that facial expression you just did. That cannot happen in your classroom. He just smiled. I mean, that would seem like, oh, that brought him joy. So if I studied it, maybe it would bring me joy. Okay, can't do that. Be monotone. Contain yourself at all costs from showing any kind of emotion, joy, excitement, and enthusiasm. Number two, do not spend any time reviewing material. Don't do that. Because what happens is sometimes enjoyment of literature stems from comprehension of literature, right? And if you review and they start to have some sense of comprehension, that's going to completely kill your goals for causing them to hate it. You got to avoid it at all costs. I had some teachers who were fantastic at this one, just growing up myself, public school. They were experts at that. Reviewing will get you into big trouble. It causes students to actually begin to comprehend. And before you had them confused and in the dark, everything was fine. If you want to be successful, cause them to hate the great books, you can't do that. Number one of our Letterman Top 10 ways to cause your students to hate the great books. Number one, whatever you do, never prepare them for the next level, especially a college experience. If by next level you mean something like Wendy's drive-through or something like that, that's fine. But don't ever teach in such a way that you're preparing them for some sort of higher level academically. The phrase I want you to write down for this one is deer in the headlights. That's what you want. You want your students to come back to you after they've gone to college, and without you even bringing up the expression, for them to use the expression, deer in the headlights experience at college. You guys know what that means, right? Yeah. Okay, so I hope that you guys have taken some notes on how to cause your students to hate the great books. So, where are we? Okay, I'll tell you what, let's do this. Let's go back through them now, and let's review them. And we're going to sort of take some inventory, all right? Because in some way or another, have we not all violated one or two or three or ten of these? Of course we have, because we're teachers and we're human. So let's walk back through them. And let's make some comments about how we can actually cause our kids to love books. So I'm going to just walk back through them now. Number 10, the key phrase here, quantity does not equal quality. Quantity does not equal quality. How many of you have ever seen great books programs where, you know, the key is to stack up the books that you read and to take a picture of that, and somehow, you know, the student's standing there smiling, they're really got the psychotic sort of look on their face because you just made them read way too many books, and somehow this is supposed to be a picture of quality. Folks, run away from that. Run away from that. As classical educators, what we're trying to do is give our students the tools of learning. The tools of learning. Let's say that expression together. Tools of learning. It's not about how many books you can cram down their throats in a year. I wrote a blog article a couple of years back for the school I head up, Wilson Hill Academy. You could go there and check it out. But I want to read an excerpt of it that has to do with this particular issue. It's not a hot dog eating contest. Devouring 69 hot dogs in 10 minutes, which is the current record. My research is correct. Can you imagine that? 69 hot dogs. What human being does that? It's not healthy. In fact, it may be hazardous to your health. Likewise, cramming too many works into the brain without learning how to process and approach the ideas is not healthy. And then I was talking about Hutchins. You guys are probably familiar with the great books, set that came out in the 1950s. The course that we teach in the great books at Wilson Hill is called The Great Conversation. So what I was doing was writing a blog article explaining to our families, why do we call this The Great Conversation and such. But in that article, he quotes Francis Bacon. And this is a really neat quote. I like this. So this actually comes from Francis Bacon. He says, some books are to be tasted, others to be swallowed, and some few to be chewed and digested. That is, some books are to be read only in parts, others to be read but not curiously, and some few to be read wholly and with diligence and attention. It's not how much you eat, it's what you eat. It's not the volume that's most important here. It's learning how to engage the ideas, think Christianly, and to learn how to arrive at godly conclusions. Now, before I go to number 9, let me say this. I read some books on great books teaching and classical education that would swing the pendulum, in my opinion, way too far to the other side, where we read one book for the entire year. That is not what I'm advocating. I don't think you're doing your students any favor by doing that. There are some books that are so rich that you could certainly spend a whole year studying them. I'm not advocating that. I'm advocating a middle ground, a golden mean, a reasonable amount of reading. And I'd be glad to share that with you later if you'd like to know. I think we all have literature courses where they're doing different amounts of reading. We actually got to the point where not that this is a super accurate way to do things, but it's at least a gauge and a start. We started counting the number of pages that a student would read in a full course, just so that we would know as we build courses that are lit-based, at least we're close to that. We don't want to be, you know, rigid about that. But if we're way off, we know that, why are we way off? And is that maybe okay, but maybe it's not. So the bottom line here is that the volume does not dictate. So if you have a Great Books program where you're reading a whole lot of books, that doesn't mean that you have a better Great Books program. Number 9, the key word is relevance. Yep. Oh, did you pay the extra fee? There was an extra... Okay, that's fine. Keep in mind that our Great Books program, like some of them have Narnia. Okay, so you're going to knock out 200 or 300, 400 pages of Narnia in no time. So, but also Plato and Aristotle. Okay, so our class was a great conversation. Starting in 7th grade, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Ancient, medieval, modern again. We're somewhere around... 2,500 to 3,200 pages. Now that's, in a year. That may sound like a lot of reading, but that's not an overwhelming amount of reading. I am constantly polling my students. I'm asking them. I'm talking to parents. Are they overwhelmed? Are they dying? Are they able to do this? We also, we don't like our students, we want our students to go outside and play in the creek in the backyard in the summertime. So we're not big into, the only way you can survive at our school is if you do massive amounts of work over the summer. That's insane. Don't do that to your students. Let them go outside and play. But we do tell them, here are the first couple of books that you're going to be reading. And, you know, it would probably be a good idea if you were at least well into the first one or something like that. So we don't make it a requirement, but it gives them a jump start and we can really hit the road running. Yeah, I've polled my students on that too. Oh, well, I'll tell you what. Let me answer the question I thought you were asking, and then I'll answer that question. I've polled my students and asked them, how much time are you spending reading? And they're spending an hour to an hour and a half, 5 days a week. Now, let me qualify that. Our Great Conversation course is 2.5 credits. Okay, so that 2,500 to 3,200 number, keep that in mind. It's a history credit, it's a literature credit, and it's a half a Bible credit. So it's 2.5 courses. So if you're teaching a literature elective or something like that, I'm not so sure you should have 3,500 pages if it's a one credit course and they're taking 6 other courses. So I would encourage you to do the math. The other question I think you're asking is how often do our students meet? They meet twice a week, 90 minutes each. So we are live, real time with our students for 90 minutes, twice, so 3 hours a week. Yeah. Okay, good questions. Number 9, the key word is relevance. Relevance. Now I want you to put a little quotey marks on there. And here's a question that I want you to come back to later and just think about it. Just ponder. It's a good question. It's a very good question, but it's not one you're going to be able to think through right now. If I were to poll my students and ask them what our studies have to do with my life in 2016, what would they say? Now, if you want to do something really scary, you could actually ask them that. Ask your students. They can be anonymously. What have you gotten out of this class that has anything to do with the year 2016? Yeah, sure. If I were to poll my students and ask them what our studies have to do with my life in 2016, what do you think they would say? If they don't see how and why this stuff matters, I think you've lost them. I really do. Then I think you have to back up and ask yourself, why are we teaching literature classes? I don't think the only reason we're teaching literature classes is so they can have application to their lives, but I think that's an important part of it. The truth is we study literature because good literature is about ideas which are universal. Good literature is about the timeless ideas throughout history. They're not bound by any one time period or any one culture. Whether you're reading Plato or Orwell, our goal is a lot of things. I'm going to say two things here. Number one, to identify what that universal idea is. And look, if there's not one there, then you may want to consider, why is that book in our list, right? But go back to probably one of the oldest known works of literature on the face of the earth, the Epic of Gilgamesh, and start asking yourself, what are the universal ideas? Well, let's just, what are the two or three universal ideas that are incredibly relevant in the Epic of Gilgamesh?
Why are we here?
Why are we here? Thank you.
Immortality.
Pagan man's futile search for immortality. Yeah. What does it mean to be human? Excellent.
Friendship.
And Kidu. Don't you love big, hairy, smelly things? Yes. My wife tells me no. Say it again.
Like the city versus the country.
Okay.
Civilization versus
not. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So are all of those ideas important ideas that could have relevance in the 21st century? Of course they are. So number one, to identify the universal idea. And then number two, to figure out what it has to do with the LGBT community. What does that thing have to do with Donald Trump or Great Britain leaving the European Union? What does it have to do with any of that? Well, if it's a truly timeless idea that transcends all culture and time, then there's an answer to it. And helping your students dig into that's an important part of why we study literature. Okay, number eight. How deep do we go? That's the question here. For at least a decade or more, people have been asking me, Bruce, this is crazy. You can't teach that set of books to students that age. How many of you have ever heard any of your parents say that? You've gotten that, I'll bet, haven't you? You can't teach Plato to a seventh grader, right? I've been hearing that over and over and over. When I first started teaching great books, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, I just was ignorant enough not to know that you couldn't do that, that you weren't supposed to, you know, bring heavy material. I was just kind of excited about it, and they gave me seventh graders, so that's what we did. So, but we do tend to shy away from those ideas. But the reality is that your students will kind of adjust in some ways, right, with reason. They will adjust to where you meet them and to where you want to take them. So if you want to stick with VeggieTales, then they'll be on a VeggieTale level with you. They'll go there with you. But if you want to take them into the deep, dark, fascinating world of Plato, they can do it. I'm not sure I'd do Plato in kindergarten, but Plato, not Plato. That was actually not in my notes. I totally promise you that was spontaneous, which is creepier. I think one of the best examples here, and this is his favorite author for me, any Dostoevsky fans? Oh, come on. Okay, I want everybody to put your hand up, because you're going to be. Seriously, we have got to read more Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky is an excellent example for us on this issue. maybe you were forced to read Crime and Punishment or Brothers K in college or something like that. Go back and reread those books. Dostoevsky's psychological novels are really like worldview novels, right? You know this. So all the characters in the novels have to do with worldviews. So each character represents some particular worldview. And when you read the novel, you're seeing where that worldview ends up. It's sort of like Francis Schaeffer, 100 years before Francis Schaeffer. Schaeffer's apologetics is, let's see where you are. Where's your car right now? What highway are you going down? All right, well, that's interesting. That's your worldview. Let's just kind of keep driving that car down the road a little bit, and let's see where it ends up. Oh, look at that. It goes off a cliff. Isn't that something? Maybe you don't want to do that, right? And so, actually, that's what Dostoevsky does. He's giving you characters who represent worldviews. And then you see they do things like commit suicide, and they do horrible, terrible things, or they do glorious, wonderful things. And so but here's the thing with Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky's non-Christian worldview characters were so powerful, they were so convincing, that literary critics in the middle and late 19th century, Russian critics, when they first read his works, they thought he was actually advocating for the non-Christian position. See that? His devil's advocate was so devilish that they thought he was the devil. That's interesting to me, because what that tells me is we have to present our students with the strongest imaginable arguments for the Christian faith. Right? What does 1 Peter 3:15 say? Sanctify, you can recite it with me if you know it. Sanctify Christ in your hearts and be ready to give a defense for the hope that is in you. Right? And so Dostoevsky's arguments, I figure if you can deal with the arguments that he presents for the non-Christian worldview, then you're ready. Because he doesn't shy away from anything. The problem of evil in the world, the relationship between faith and reason, the role of science in light. I mean, he tackles it all. So I think Dostoevsky is a really good example for us in this area. But I think one of the things that we do, I think we do it more so in our science classes, but we do it in our literature classes too, is we give our students straw man images that they can take their pinata bats and beat on while we're in the bubble of the Christian school. And then what happens? They've been beaten on this straw man pinata. Oh, here are the arguments against the new atheist movement, or here are the real arguments against Marxism, or here are the arguments against gay marriage. And then they go off to the university and they realize, you know, those arguments are really not that strong. And you never really gave me an accurate picture of what the opposite view was. So now I'm not only getting the opposite view, but it's very powerfully articulated by folks with PhDs. I don't know what to do. I guess I'm just going to have to leave the faith. How many of you have heard that story from graduates? Sadly, the last 25 years, I've heard it too many times. You may have heard the expression, he knows just enough karate to get his butt kicked. Have you ever heard that one? You know, you get two karate lessons and you think you're Chuck Norris, and you go out onto the streets and you get destroyed. I think in some ways, and then you become disillusioned, and what do you say? Well, I guess my teacher didn't know what he was talking about, because I thought I was ready to face the world. Well, I think in some ways, we do that. When we, in our literature and science classes in particular, when we give our students fairly lame arguments from what the other side is saying. And, you know, I tell my teachers, I want our students to be able to deal with the strongest possible argument in favor of evolution that Richard Dawkins can muster up. And if they can work through and deal with the strongest argument that Richard Dawkins can muster up, then I think that's probably a pretty good place to send them off. But the truth of the matter is, we're sometimes a decade, sometimes multiple decades behind with our old, stale, washed up arguments in apologetics. And the Richard Dawkins types are just kind of shaking their heads thinking, good grief, who let them in the debate? How did they even get to the table? And it's embarrassing for us. And we're not doing our kids a service by doing that. Dostoevsky, I think, is the example here, because he offers profound responses to heavy questions, and it's not just something you can slap on a bumper sticker. When Dostoevsky wrestles with the problem of evil, you've got to read Brothers Karamazov. You can't just raise your hand, oh, Bruce, what does he say? Well, the book's about 800 pages. Read it. It's a thoughtful response. It's a substantive response. And the sooner we get away from thinking that we have to give 30-second soundbite answers to squash the atheist or Marxist or whatever the other guy is, the better we'll be. But judging from current political discourse, I'm not sure if we're moving in that direction, right? Politics. Number 7. Just because we are studying books that were written a long time ago, it doesn't mean that we have to study them as though we're living a long time ago. It really is kind of a bit silly if you think about it. Plato and Virgil and Aquinas might very well have used technology if they have had access to it. Is it reasonable for me to conclude that? That they probably would have used the technology they had. I don't see any of those guys saying, okay, we're just going to stick with our bow ties and we're just going to kind of keep it Luddite. No, they used the technology they had during their day. Why would we not do that? Here's one of those unintended consequences I want to talk with you about. When we play that role, that, ooh, isn't it kind of cool to be the non-technology guy? You know, there's one in every school, right? There's at least one or 10 in every school. The problem is this. Our teenagers are both, at the same time, they are advanced and clueless at the same time. So they are advanced in technology, right? They know how to use it way better than you or I do, for the most part. But they're also clueless in that their maturity level has not caught up with their technological abilities. Let me say that again. Their maturity level hasn't caught up with their technological abilities. So here's what happens. When you say, well, I'm the anti-technology guy. Never heard of Facebook. I live in a cave. And I just read books written on wax tablets or parchments or things like that. And I smoke a pipe, and I don't shave or take a shower. Like, okay, Bruce, that's good, we got it. When you're that guy, here's what you're missing. You're missing an opportunity to model for your immature yet technologically advanced students how they should do it. Oh, I have 5 kids. One of them's 18. And the problem we've had with our teenage kids is, oh, did you really just put that on Facebook? Oh, you didn't think about that, did you? Yeah, you didn't think about the fact that that's out there for good, forever. You can't take it back. No eraser. That's the struggle I have with my own children. But you, as a teacher, you have the opportunity to say, what does discretion mean in social media? What does wisdom mean in how you conduct yourself in an online setting, a social media setting, on Twitter, or whatever the case may be? You're missing that. And you're allowing them to move on down the road another step, getting more advanced in their technology, and either remaining the same or becoming less mature in their abilities to use it. That's like continuing to give them larger weapons and no training at all on how to use them. Why would we do that? Use technology as an opportunity to teach maturity, sanctification, growth. All right, number six. You really do want to make lecture a rare practice. In a literature class, I could almost say that I would be comfortable telling my teachers never. Never. You don't. There's really no need to do anything more than a 3 to 5 minute lecture. It's just, you don't need to do it. Oh, but I've got to give background on the American Civil War before we read Uncle Tom's Cabin. That's fantastic. They can read that. And then you can use your class time to talk about Uncle Tom's Cabin and the implications and the applications and all that. But I would make lecture either non-existent or a very rare practice. It's called the great conversation, not the great lecture. And a conversation means multiple voices from all of history are involved, and you're trying to bring your students in to be yet another 15 or so voices to join that conversation, not to watch you have the conversation. There's a difference between watching someone else have a conversation and joining into the conversation yourself. I sort of cut my teeth on great books teaching and learning at Veritas Academy in Leola. Ty Fisher was my boss there. He's the guy that helped write the Omnibus curriculum. And I got a quote from him that I thought was really helpful. I used to hear him say this a lot. He was my headmaster. He said, "Omnibus is simply reading great books and coming to class ready to talk about what you've read." I was like, oh. Everybody, you should just slump your shoulders over and go, oh, that's kind of freeing, isn't it? Just, that's it. Teaching a great book. It's simply reading great books and then coming to class ready to talk about it. That's really what your course is. And if you do that effectively, it will be life-changing for your students. Inviting your students to enter into a great conversation, get them talking. I just actually read a book that I think is helpful on this. Anybody familiar with James Taylor, not the singer, Poetic Knowledge? Does that book resonate with any of you? Okay, a few of you. Yeah, good book. What's it called? Eighth Day Books. I think they have a booth. okay, my cousin Vinny does not own that company. I know nothing else about them. But that's called Poetic Knowledge. Really good read. Very thoughtful read on that issue. All right, number five. Be able to recognize that you don't know everything. Let students discover things that even you don't know. There's a balance here, right? You are the teacher, and you should know quite a bit more than your students know. What is the first law of the seven laws of teaching? The teacher has to know that which he or she would teach. So you need to be the expert. But there's something special about saying, hey, guys, let's all gather around and learn something today. Notice I use the first person plural there. Let's all gather around and let's talk, let's read. Not necessarily always, I'm the imparter of wisdom, sit at my feet kind of thing. Number four, another question to ask yourself. What does a typical class of mine look like? What does a typical class of mine look like? If there is an answer to this question, you may have a problem. If there's any answer to this question, you may have a problem. Be sure that you're using a variety of types of classes. Okay, look, I almost feel sorry for the other departments in the school. Don't you guys? I mean, don't we have the most amazing material, content-wise? I'm serious. History, literature, theology, philosophy. Try to mix it up. We do a lot of debates. Debates are good. You do have to kind of regulate them and oversee them, but debates are good. Recitations are good. I like to do courtroom scenes. Courtroom scenes are good, especially if you're doing, you know, Aeschylus, maybe. Good courtroom scene. But acting out a play, having a feast day. I like to do masquerade parties. Now, masquerade parties, Laura will know this, are a little bit easier online. So students log in, they can change their name. And nobody knows who they are. So Bilbo's in the room, and Frodo's in the room, and C.S. Lewis is hanging out in there too. So the students have just changed their names. But when the teacher is leading the discussion, they're all speaking from the worldview of that person. So imagine if you could have, you know, C.S. Lewis and Karl Marx and Aristotle in a room together and just kind of watch them have a talk. And it's even more fun when the kids have those names and they're trying to talk like those people would talk. But it's a different level, I think, of engagement. It's one thing to say, well, I think Aristotle would say this or that. It's another thing to change your voice and act like you're Aristotle and say it. Masquerade parties. All right, number three. Please, I beg of you, whatever you do, if you get nothing else out of this, bring some joy and humor into your classroom, for Pete's sake. The classroom ought to be the highlight of their day. It ought to be a blast. It ought to be laughing in some cases that stomachs are hurting and liquids are coming out of nostrils. And I mean, that should happen sometimes. That should happen sometimes. I mean it. We should have a lot of humor in the classroom. Jokes are good things. The Bible talks about humor being a good thing, and I think we should have plenty of it in our classroom. Now, I'm not talking about a, you know, sort of a good time Charlie kind of atmosphere. I'm talking about substantive, you know, thoughtful learning, but with appropriate humor. It breaks things up. It keeps their attention. It also helps them to associate, get a little Freudian here, associate the experience with something that's joyful and happy and, hey, that was, well, hey, it's 30 years later. I do remember that class. It was fun. But they learned way more than they thought, than they even realized at that level of their lives. Got to have humor in the classroom. What is the seventh of the seventh laws of teaching? Seven laws of teaching. Review. Thank you. And how many of you remember that he says that's the most important one, right? John Milton Gregory says of the seven laws, review is the most important one. But that's interesting to me. That's the one book that I always go back to. I like to read books on teaching and education, but the Seven Laws of Teaching, to me, is just so critical, so foundational, so simple yet profound. And he says that the most important is review. What I recommend is 10 minutes at the beginning, reviewing previous material, and stop 10 minutes early and review what you've just done. So review caps off your lesson. Now, what we implemented a couple of years ago, which I had never really done before, but wondered how it would work, can't tell you how well I think it's working. We give a 5-question quiz at the beginning of class. Super quick. You could even probably find creative ways to have them do this, and it's self-graded, and it doesn't even eat up a lot of class time. So what I do is 2 to 3 questions, review what we did in the previous class. And then 2 to 3 questions, review something from the previous semester or way back. Now, obviously, in September, you've only got this much. But when I give a quiz in April, let's just say April the 17th, the quiz on April the 17th reviews what I did on April the 16th, but it also has a couple of questions from October. So they're not going to forget. I teach one class I teach, Great Conversation 3, starts with the death of Queen Elizabeth in 1603, the new dynasty, and then you've got the fights between, you know, king and parliament, leads up to the English Civil War, and the first book we read is the Westminster Confession. So it sets that context. I can pretty safely say that on the last day of school, my students know that Queen Elizabeth died in 1603. That's just, I keep asking it, and they get that context. So you're always, 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 always reviewing short-term, reviewing long-term. Lateral thinking, tying it all in as often as you can. Okay. As the head of our school, I frequently tell our teachers that we want to avoid the deer in the headlights. So let's go back to the deer in the headlights. Now, I do realize that the parents are ultimately the ones who are responsible for their children's education. I get that. We all know that. But we want to do everything we can to prepare them in a way that they do not have the deer in the headlights moment. I do believe, by and large, as I said earlier, many of our Christian schools are not preparing our students for the rigorous university experience. We barely scratch the surface when it comes to helping our students become educated and discuss philosophies like Marxism, feminism, new atheism. How many of you are familiar with the new atheist movement? It's, some people say it's kind of dying now. I don't know. It's probably not. New atheism is unique in that it's not just atheism. It's atheism with a vengeance. It's evangelistic atheism. Okay. When I was growing up, there have always been atheists, right? There were always atheists. And I don't know that there are any more atheists now than there have ever been, percentage-wise. But atheists always seem to sort of stay to themselves, and they may get mad about some religious issue in the public school or something every once in a while, but for the most part, they were just atheists. The new atheist movement, I just read a book actually about a year ago, by a guy named Peter Boghossian. I read this book. He's a professor at Seattle State University, called A Manual for Creating Atheists. A Manual for Creating Atheists. How many of you did the D. James Kennedy Evangelism Explosion? You guys ever heard of that? You are way too young for that, young lady. That's my era. How in the world? She's reading Ovid and doing It's like Evangelism Explosion for atheists. He actually uses terms like friendship evangelism. He uses that exact term. How you get to know people and become friends, build a relationship, and then techniques to walk them away from their faith. I want to get you away from your faith because your faith is damaging to you. You're living you're deluded. It's not healthy. And it's even worse that you would abuse your children by raising them in that kind of environment. So it's a sort of a militant, very proactive kind of thing. So are our students ready? I mean, are you really ready to cut them loose on the university campus where half their teachers are going to be Marxists? Who knows who's going to be in the bathroom? We won't even get started on what's going to be in the bathroom, what's happening in the LGBT community. And in a non-joking kind of way, not something that I'm happy about, that we have to study something like this on an intellectual level, but queer theory. How many of you have ever heard, are you familiar with the, okay, good. I mean, the thing is it okay that our students, and look, I know they're 17 and 18. This is just a really nasty dilemma that we're in here.
But do we want them to go to the university and hear those expressions for the first time there? I would rather discuss it with them in the safety of the Christian worldview environment. We're teaching a course next year. I've just been disturbed about this issue for a few years now. And so we're going to offer a course next year at Wilson Hill called Modern Literature and Thought. And the idea with this course, first of all, is to read. Thank you, Rob. So we've got a few minutes. Is to read books and authors that they would not read in any other lit courses. So, you know, the standard Great Books program, you guys know, you named all of them earlier. But in the Modern Lit course, we're going to kind of move out of that sort of safety comfort zone, read James Joyce, read Virginia Woolf, read Kafka, and read Camus, and other 20th and 21st century authors. And then talk, hopefully substantively, about those issues so that when they get on the university campus and they're dealing with the LGBT community, queer theory, different forms of Marxism and such, that's okay. I kind of knew that was coming. Mr. Hunter told me all about it. So I'm comfortable with functioning here, and I don't have the deer in the headlights kind of thing. I want to close with this. For years, my students used to say something to me that I didn't know how to respond to it. I mean, years and years and years. They used to say to me, miss you, because, you know, you're all, those of you who teach literature, okay, raise your hands if you really, 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 it's three really, if you really, really, really like it, okay, if not, yeah, do something else. But you should. It's a blast. I love it. And so how many of you, you've probably done the same thing I do. Oh, we just finished so-and-so, Tell Two Cities, and man, it's my favorite. But we're going to be moving on up, and we're going to read Uncle Tom's Cabin. It's my favorite. And they're like, Mr. Renner, you say every book is your favorite. No, I don't. No, Mr. Renner, really, you do. The problem is in the online class is we archive every single class. There's evidence, right? It's there. They can play it back. You just said that 27 books were your favorite. You can't tonight. Okay, fine. I have an answer for him now. I have an answer for him now. I just read a fantastic quote from St. Augustine. In fact, I think I got it out of that Poetic Knowledge book. Listen to this. This is great. Write this down so you can respond when they try to pin you on this one. To know a thing, we must in some way come to love it. To know a thing, we must in some way come to love it. That doesn't mean embrace the worldview. That doesn't mean agree with it. It means become intimately and intricately involved with it in a way that you love it. I love the Aeneid. I know that it's a work that praises a pagan culture. I know that. But I love Virgil and I love the Aeneid. And that's important. Someone recently asked me why I teach with such enthusiasm. I wasn't really sure until I thought about it. And maybe your testimony is similar to this. And if you've never understood maybe what it is, that you ever, you know, having a mediocre day, and then all of a sudden when you get in the classroom, something, some little button clicks. And all of a sudden you just become this excited. And you're like, I don't know why that is. And then it goes away sometimes when you walk out of the classroom. It took me, I'm 46, I just realized this past year why that is. I grew up in a fairly strict, maybe even semi-fundamentalist Christian home. Good, fantastic parents, but not a whole lot of backbone to the teaching and theology. So when I went off to the big school, I became an agnostic. I left it all behind. I couldn't answer the arguments that were being given to me. I had no weapons, no abilities at all. And so I had to work through that. Took me about a decade. So when I read the great books, it was personal. I read Plato asking myself, do I believe this? Is he right? What does that have to do with Scripture? And so when I read the great thinkers of Western culture, I was interacting with them. It was a matter of life and death for me. This wasn't just a detached, you know, academic exercise to write a paper and turn in an assignment to, you know, get my C+, if I could somehow eke that out. I've got high standards. studying the great books was not a detached academic experience for me. It was personal. It was intimate. It's always been emotional. And by entering into the great conversation with these thinkers, I've come to love their works. And my knowledge of them is more than bare facts, and it stems from that love. I want to encourage all of you here to enter into that conversation, heart, soul, and come to love the great books so that that love is passed on to your students because you love them. Yeah, God bless. Any questions? We have only about 4 or 5 minutes, maybe. But yeah. Yeah, well, okay, so that's a tough question because I teach in an online classroom. So everything I do is, we have a whiteboard and I can throw a website up in a blink. I can put any work of art that's ever been done on a whiteboard in 2 seconds. So you could do that. I've seen that done effectively where there's a laptop and a projector and you can throw it up quickly. It sure does beat, okay, guys, get out your art history books and let's open up to 873. So that's one thing that you can do. I'll tell you what else we do that I would highly recommend, okay, because this even blends in with what people actually really do. Anybody here familiar with the Well-Trained Mind website? The website, okay. You ever go to the forums? Okay, so mom says, DD... That means dear daughter. I just learned that. DD is a rising fifth grader, and we're looking for a math curriculum. Okay? And then all the other moms jump in, and they're like, and they post, threads. Love you, Singapore, and we use Saxon. And they, okay. So what we do is this thing called a discussion board. You can still do this if you're teaching in a bricks and mortar school, but this takes the discussion outside of the classroom. It extends the classroom. And it gives you a ton more mileage. So what we do is I post the big question of the week. Okay. The big idea. The big, we're wrestling with, Milton this week. And here's the thing. And then, but here's what I tell them. This is so important. It's not a writing assignment, per se. It's a discussion assignment. It's a discussion board. So what happens is we use Canvas as our learning management system. You can program it in such a way that they can't see everyone else's comments until they make one. So once they make a comment, then they can say, oh, look, 15 students have responded. And the whole idea is for Billy to respond to Susie and for Susie to say whatever she wants back and to have this discussion that's extended for hours. And here's the secret. Are there any students in here? The secret is they're doing an assignment, and they're having so much fun doing it that they kind of don't realize it. And it's a really cool assignment. So I think for literature-based stuff, I would say the discussion boards. Check them out. There's got to be a way that you could probably, in fact, my wife probably knows, of an LMS that you can use for free. Okay, so there's a Canvas that a teacher can use that you don't have to pay for. We can give you a little information on that later, but that's a good question. Yeah.
You mentioned lectures should be a rare practice to speak lectures out, but then yet in Omnibus, every book begins with a lecture. I always joke and say, how are we going to ruin the ending of the book?
Okay, that's why I do not have my students read The Tale of Two Cities essays in that book. We banned them. We had a burning. There's a few other essays, which I won't mention, because the authors of some of those essays are here this week. In fact, the author of the Tale of Two Cities essay, I think, was one of our plenary speakers. So, I probably won't be invited back. It was nice knowing you guys.
I'm right here with
you. Yeah, thank you. So, I do that, but they read the essay outside of class. So, if I'm starting a Tale of Two Cities on Monday, okay, new book. Iliad. If I'm starting the Iliad on Monday, they are supposed to have read that essay before we start. So they've already got a little bit of background. Then I'll do some review. Oh, you guys should have read that. So what do you think? Who's Homer and when did he live and why did he write this? And so we'll start, but it's still all discussion. Does that make sense? Okay. Yes, sir. Oh, absolutely. I highly recommend it. Well, I'm an in-the-text guy, and some of that might be from my seminary training, but I'm an in-the-text guy. I want everybody holding the text, and I want us all to be on the same page, and we're engaging in that text. So that's how we do it. Now, so if we're reading something and there's a famous speech, I'll have the students change their voices and read the speech. If they're, I don't have time to do large portions, but we are always reading portions in class. So if we're walking through a text, well, okay, guys, look over at blah, blah, blah. Let's just see what Aeneas just said to Dido. What do you, and then let's read, okay, so somebody reads it. Yeah, what do you think about that? So just really quick, keep it moving, but we're always in the text. We're not just reading and then coming and talking about that text. That text is right here. Yeah. Can you come by the booth? Yeah, I've got a bunch of them. I'm on the Wilson Hill Academy booth. Yeah, I've got. In fact, I can give you my card and just send you the book list for that class. Yeah. Okay.
How can I do some of these professional
things? Are you one of the two? Okay, so there are actually three. Okay, I'll tell you what we did at Veritas Academy, and we had classes that small. Get the desks out of the room, go to Costco and get little leather couches, and put a pot of coffee on, and it's living room now. And we're sitting around the living room, and I'm serious. That's exactly what we did. So just make the environment fit. You got three people sitting around. What are you going to do? Stick them in a wooden desk and have them facing the front of a room while you write on a board? That's crazy. Yeah, get some couches. Leather. Leather? No. Spring for the faux leather, at least. Truly, yes. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Yeah, no. I've done both, but that's just what we do right now. But, yeah. Yeah, that's number 10, isn't it?
Yes.
Did I skip that?
No.
I didn't elaborate on it? No, I'm so sorry. Herodotus, one of my all-time favorite books ever. It's my stranded on... I'm totally serious. If you want to come out and say what? I'm stranded on a deserted island. That's my book. And it pains me to do it, but I shrink it down to about 40%. We shrink Thucydides down to about 40%. Because, and here's the gauge for me is, can I still accomplish everything I want to accomplish and read 40% of that book? If the answer is yes, you really should do that. You can't read portions of novels. I mean, you can't read... There are certain books you just can't do that. But City of God? Don't do that. How many of you... Can we have one quick confession? Did anybody make your... I know, that was a good one. Did anybody make your students read all of City of God? That's brutal. You should be charged with some sort of lit crime of some kind. Yes.
I have a question.
Yep.